Hello, can you hear me? Okay. Happy Sabbath. Good. How's everyone doing today? I hope the answer is great. Okay. That means everything is fine and there's room for improvement if it's only good. Not great. It's really good to be here. I'm excited to speak today. I want to say thanks to Bill and his family. Tina, Frank, Sarah, for letting us participate in that blessing. That's always a joy. That's always a joy to do. The title of my message today is, What Are You Going to Do About It? Now, typically when I speak, I might give you some intro that's really interested to get you sucked into my message. Or I might have some humor. Today, I really want to get into the point, because when I look at where we are today in August 2022, there's a lot of political unrest in this country. You look at the news and there's always conflict about this person said this person said that, he did this, he did that. And it's not even on the soap operas anymore. It's our government. On top of that, there's a lot of international conflict. Right? Russia is invading Ukraine, and you have Europe on edge. China's dropping bombs and missiles on the Straits of Taiwan and in the Pacific, and Kim Jong-il is firing missiles everywhere. So I scrapped my regularly scheduled sermon for a message that I hope gives you encouragement and helps you to stay focused in your life. So what are you going to do about it? There are three principles that I want you to leave here with today. They're embedded all in the message, but I'm going to tell you what they are up front. And they're simple. They're things you know. But sometimes we can forget. And we forget because we're looking at all the political unrest. And this person said that, and that person did this. Or we're looking at, oh no, there's a war in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin might launch a nuclear bomb, or South Korea is going to do something, or Iran is going to do something, or Pakistan is going to do something. God is in control. That's the first point. The second one is something that I think we forget. It's something I'm probably going to harp on a little bit today. When we think about time, do you realize that the time is something that's made for us, not God? He exists outside of it. So what do I mean? We know what a day is, right? And what is a day? A day is just the time it takes for the earth that we are living on to make one rotation. But there's a time when the earth didn't exist, but God did. How long was a day then? Think about that. Well, a year is when the earth goes around the sun 364 1/4 times. But there was a time when the sun didn't exist. So God has an eternal vision. And my third point, with everything that's going on, the disruptions on the international stage and in our country, that our salvation is God's number one priority, and it should be ours. So let's get into this message about What are you going to do about it? I want to highlight God's being in control and God's eternal vision. I'm going to start in Genesis 15. And in verse 2 it says, God had promised Abraham great rewards. And in verse 2, Abraham said, Lord God, what will you give me, seeing that I go childless, and the steward of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? See, Abraham was already blessed with material wealth. In the chapters before, he just fought a battle with the servants in his household and won. In verse 3, it says, and Abraham said, behold, to me you have given me no seed. So one who was born in my house is my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this shall not be your heir, but one shall come forth out of you, and he will be your heir. And he took him outside, and he said, look towards the heavens and tell me the stars, if you are able to number them. He said, so shall your offspring be. And Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him righteousness. So I want us to stop here. Right now, Abraham is an old man with no children. He's been married for a while, so I assume he's tried a couple times. But no children. But he's acquired a lot of other stuff. And he's saying to God, you haven't given me any offspring. So what is the point of all of this? I'm going to pass it on to one of the servants born within my household. But God said, I am going to give you an offspring. Now remember the title of my message? It's what are you going to do about it? One of the things that I want to be crystal clear is when God has a plan, we just go along with it. I'm going to show you about a whole lot of people in this Bible to try to help God out with his plans. Okay? Do you think you can help God out with his plans? Do you think he needs you to get his will accomplished? Or do you think he's in control and he knows what he's doing? So remember, Abraham, being up in age and having no offspring, he looked up at the sky, he saw the stars, and he believed God. He said, okay, that's what you said. That's what's going to happen. So, we know what happened. Because we know how people think. Abraham and his wife Sarah decided to help God out with the plan. And when we help God out with the plan, it doesn't necessarily go as well as it would have. What do I mean by that? So, God is going to give him a promise. If we drop down to verse 13, Abraham is going to fall into a deep sleep. And remember, he doesn't have any children, but God is going to show us of his eternal nature. In verse 13, I'm going to break into the middle of the chapter when he's asleep. He says, and he said to Abraham, know surely that your seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and they shall be enslaved, and they shall serve them for 400 years. Also, that nation whom they shall serve, I will judge, and afterward they will come out with great wealth. you will go to your fathers in peace, and you will be buried at a good old age. But in the fourth generation, you shall come here again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. He's saying a lot. What he is doing, he's promising them the promised land. That's before Abraham ever had any children. This promised land is promised to them. But he's also telling him they're going to have to go through some stuff. 400 years of slavery. So before they ever set foot in Egypt, that 400 years of slavery was predicted. But listen to this covenant in verse 18. It says, in that same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, unto your seed, I will give you this land from the river of Egypt unto the great river Euphrates. Did you catch that? Because when we think about the promised land, we just think about the nation of Israel and Palestine. Because guess what? That's all the Israelites ever occupied. Do you realize that that's like less than one-tenth of what they could have had? This is what he says. He says, the Kenites, the Kenzites, the Kadites, the Hittites, Perizzites, Raphaimites and Amorites and the Canaanites, the Girgashites and the Jebusites. Those were all the people that lived in those lands. Well, how could this go wrong? God is going to give them all this land from Euphrates. That's over in Iraq. Understand that. That's the land of the Babylonians, the Chaldeans. How did this happen? Well, let's start in verse 16. It says, now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. Uh-oh, they're about to help God out. And Sarai said unto Abram, behold, now the Lord has restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go into thy maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of his wife Sarai. What? In verse 4 it says, he went into Hagar and she conceived. And when she saw that she conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. For time, I will speed up the story, okay? So now Abraham has baby mama drama, Jerry Springer style, in his house. Now seriously, when you read the Bible, okay, even when you go to church, people like to clean up the humanity of what really happened. But he had baby mama drama, Jerry Springer style, in his house because he tried to help God out. So it was like, get out my house now without food. I'm going to be cruel and evil to you because you got pregnant, because I wanted you to get pregnant and you got pregnant. But now you think you're better than me. And we're going to fight for control of this household. So what happened? Did God lie? No. Abraham's seed still got all of that land. But not the seed of promise, which was to come through Isaac. It wasn't time yet. There's a couple things I want us to look at in this verse. One of the things he said when he made that promise to Abraham He said, the sin of the Amorites, the iniquity of the Amorites, has not yet been filled. And I want children of God to think about this, because many times in the Bible or in the church, we think that God is only working with us. But God is the Father of everybody on this planet. And He is working with everyone. He's in touch with everyone. And I'm going to go through the scriptures today so we are clear about that. So we saw this promise that God made, a promise that's going to take 700 years, 800 years to be truly fulfilled. Abraham has to have Isaac. Isaac has to have Jacob. Jacob has to have Israel. Israel has to have Joseph. Joseph has to go to Egypt, become the leader. They have to go through a famine. And Egypt is now elevated to the most powerful country on earth because of Joseph. Why? No one else has food. They are the only place that has food because of Joseph. He said, you're going to have 7 years of plenty, and there's going to be a 7-year famine. So they're now the most powerful place on the earth. And the Israelites, who have now moved in, begin to increase and multiply. Now, sometime after Joseph's death, the Pharaoh that is around, that didn't know what Joseph did for his people, so some time must have passed, started enslaving them. And that went on for 400 years. They were liberated by God. They wandered through the desert because of their disobedience. And only then did they start to possess that promise. So I want you to think about how much time it took. So when we see these situations, whether it's two superpowers fighting over Taiwan, or an autocrat that wants to take Ukraine, God isn't looking at just today or tomorrow or next month. He knows what the situations today, how they're going to impact His planet and His church 10 years, 20 years, 30 years down the line. We can't see that far. We can't see that far. I want you to think back. Think back 20 years ago in your life. If you think back 20 years ago in your life, most of the people in this room would not even be here. Guess what? 20 years ago, I had 0 children. I wasn't married. I didn't live where I live now. I had hair. No gray. I dropped out of college, and everyone is like, oh no, he dropped out of college to start that tiny little computer business. What a dummy. That's what people were saying about me 20 years ago. So where were you in your walk with God? What kind of relationship did you have? Were you baptized? And the reason that that's important is I want to give you perspective. God knew 20 years ago what He had for you. God knew 20 years ago where every single one of my 7 children, how they would come to be here. So we can't be short-sighted when we look at the mess and the confusion today and think, oh no, God doesn't have this under control. Let's help him out. So God is telling Abram at this time what he is going to do. In Daniel 5, we're going to read about King Belshazzar. Now, the Israelites have been taken into captivity at this time, a long time ago, and the kingdom of Judah was also taken into captivity by the Babylonians. When the Babylonians took the kingdom of Judah, they took all of their religious implements that God made for his temple. Now, King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While King Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the kings and his nobles, his wives and concubines, might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king, his nobles, his wives and concubines drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall. The king watched as the hand wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. The king summoned his enchanters, astrologers, diviners. Then he said to these wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tell me what it means will be clothed in purple and gold and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." They couldn't do it. They couldn't say what it means. Daniel is brought before the king in verse 13. So it says, "So Daniel is brought before the king, and the king said to him, 'Are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father, the king, brought from Judah? I have heard that the spirit of the gods is in you, in that you might have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and to tell me what it means, but they could not explain it. Now I have heard that you are able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing, tell me what it means, and you'll be clothed in purple, have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom.'" Daniel had no interest in his trinkets. In verse 18, he said, "Your Majesty, the God Most High gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the nations and peoples of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled." I want us to get this. I want us to be clear. Daniel is making it clear that God was the one who allowed Nebuchadnezzar to rule. Not only that, he gave Nebuchadnezzar power over every kingdom on this earth. I don't know why it is so hard for the church to understand that God is in control. We're the church. That's what we're supposed to get. You don't come to the church and ask for God to bless your child unless you expect God to really be in control. If God is not in control, this church and your faith is worthless. So God was in control when he gave Nebuchadnezzar his high position a position over everybody, a position to put to death people when he felt like it. I want to be 100% clear on that. Because Christians, believers, preachers, and politicians start acting like they don't know what's in this Bible. But here's the problem. When his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. No matter how much power God gives someone, they still got to answer to him. I don't care if you're on the Supreme Court, your title is president, prime minister, general, mayor, governor, pastor, you still have to answer to God. Everyone does, and there's no escaping that. So when I say God is in control, the church should rejoice. God is in control. When you have a problem, you can always go to him. When you have a need, you can go to him. Nebuchadnezzar, the greatest man that ever lived, human. He was driven away from his people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like an ox. And his body was drenched in the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all the kingdoms on the earth, and he sets over them anyone he wishes. I think God is going to have to do this to some Christians and some preachers and some politicians. Because they don't get this. They think somehow they're more arrogant than Nebuchadnezzar. See, Nebuchadnezzar, he learned his lesson. I promise you he did. Having to go through that, you learn too. You know, back in the day, what my parents would say to the kids, you're going to learn today. Well, he learned. What do I want out of this message? I want the church of God and Christians to say that they actually believe what's in verse 21. The Lord Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on the earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. I think some Christians don't believe that. I think some preachers don't believe that. I had to leave my last church because for 4 years they didn't believe that. They sure didn't. In verse 22, it says, but you, Belshazzar, his son, you have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. This was Belshazzar's problem. So come on, church, do we know this? Do we believe this? That number one, God is in control and he can do what he wants? Imagine that. God gets to do that. This should be Christianity 101. Like, seriously, this is an easy message to tell Christians that God is in control. You would think. In verse 25, it said, this is the inscription that was written. Many, many, tekel, parson, or upharsin, depending on what translation you're reading. It says, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. You have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. So just as Abraham was told hundreds of years into the future that I'm going to give your children the kingdoms of the Jebusites, Amorites, Hittites, and all those other ites, those seven tribes in Canaan. But he said, you know what? Their sins aren't filled yet. It's in my timing. Their sins aren't filled yet. It's the same thing he says here. God said, I'm going to end your reign. He does that sometimes. He can do it for people we like. He can do it for people we don't like. And you don't have a vote. You might go to the ballot box, you might put something in it, but you don't have a vote. Oh, wait a minute. What's the message, the title of my message again? What are you going to do about it? All right, you're going to go out and vote. That's what you're going to do. Okay. Let me know how that works out. You have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. We don't get to weigh. We don't have the scales. We will pick wrong. That very night, Belshazzar, king of Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at age 62. So can God make a regime change if he wants to? He absolutely can. Well, what if the person is really, 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 really evil? What if they're really bad? I'm glad you asked. Let's go to 1 Kings 21, 25 to 29. And we're going to talk about a really, really, really evil king. I actually like this verse, even though it's talking about someone in the Bible. I just think it's humorous. 1 Kings chapter 21. And we're going to read verses 25 through 29. In verse 25 of 1 Kings 21, it says, "There was never anyone like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the eyes of the Lord, urged on by Jezebel, his wife. He behaved in the vilest manner, by going after idols like the Amorites the Lord drove out before Israel." Basically, this is saying out of all the bad people that have come in the Bible, there's never been somebody so bad, so evil, so vile. Remember back in Genesis, the reason that God drove out the Amorites was because they were sinning. They were sinning so bad, but he said, I'm still going to have patience with them. By how long? Well, about 700 years. And he's saying that this Ahab, knowing why God drove them out, he still behaved like them. Worse, he sold himself. And God sent Elijah to just give him a bad prophecy, tell him how bad things are going to be for him because of his behavior. But in verse 27, it says, "When Ahab heard these words, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and fasted. He laid in sackcloth and went around meekly." Wait, is this the same person we're talking about? Because I thought that this was a bad guy. He was the most evil person. He was the most vilest. There was never anyone this evil. That's what it said the verse before. But that message came and it did something to his heart. Imagine that, God giving an evil ruler the chance to repent. What? God's going to allow someone to change? Huh. Maybe that was old school God. God can't do that now. Evil people can't change anymore, right? Well, that's it for church today. All the bad habits you want that you're struggling with, sorry, there's no hope. No, guess what? I want God to be able to change these evil people. You know why? Because that means he can change me. That means the things that I'm struggling with, the things that I have a hard time with, he can fix. Because if he can fix Ahab, the most evil man, right? It's in the Bible. You can always say, I'm not as bad as him, right? So he can work on you. This is what it did. It says, then the word of the Lord came to Elijah, the Tishbite, and he said, have you noticed how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has humbled himself before me, I will not bring this disaster in his day. What? So God was moved by an act of repentance? You got to be kidding me. Remember the story of Jonah? It's the same thing. We had this evil king and evil people. They actually repented. And Jonah, the Christian, yeah, I know he wasn't a Christian per se, was upset that they repented. So here we have this. And God said, no, I'm not going to bring that disaster on you. 2 Chronicles 33. In 2 Chronicles chapter 33, beginning in verse 1, it says, Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 55 years. That's a long time. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, following the detestable practices of the nations the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. Wow. It goes through all the evil he did. And in verse 10, it said, the Lord had spoken to Manasseh and his people, but they paid no attention. So the Lord brought against them the army commanders of the king of Assyria, who took Manasseh prisoner. They put a hook in his nose and bound him with bronze shekels and took him to Babylon. In his distress, he sought favor with the Lord his God and humbled himself greatly before the God of his ancestors. And when he prayed to him, the Lord was moved by his entreaty and listened to his plea, so he brought him back to Jerusalem and to his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew the Lord is God. When you think of Manasseh, we typically think of him as an evil king because he mostly was. But I want to make that point when it comes to leadership. And again, it tells you about all of the evil things that they did. How bad was this man? You know what? Let's read verse 6 of chapter 33. I skipped it over for time, but I don't think y'all hearing me. He sacrificed his children in the fire in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. He practiced divination and witchcraft, sought omens, and consulted mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the eyes of the Lord, arousing his anger. So if you want to know why he got a hook put through his nose, he earned it. He also got forgiven. So hopefully I've proven the point. God is in control. And he doesn't look at things just in the short term. In Daniel 4, we're actually going to go a chapter in front of where I started today when we went to Daniel. It says, King Nebuchadnezzar, to the nations and peoples of every language who live on earth, may you prosper greatly. It is my pleasure to tell you about the miraculous signs and wonders that the Most High God has performed for me. How great are his signs? How mighty are his wonders? His eternal is an eternal kingdom. His kingdom is an eternal kingdom. His dominion endures from generations to generations. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at home in my palace, content and prosperous. I had a dream that made me afraid. As I was lying in bed, the images and visions that passed through my mind terrified me. So I commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be brought before me to interpret the dream. So he's going to tell about this dream he has of this huge tree touching the skies, being shelter for all the animals. It was visible from every end of the earth. And that tree represented him. So I want you to get that this is not a Christian king. But God is still saying to him, I'm giving you power over everything. So the dream that they referenced before, this is what we're talking about. But in verse 14, it says, he called out in a loud voice. I'm sorry, we'll start in 13. In the visions that I saw while lying in the bed, I looked, and before me was a holy one, a messenger coming out from heaven. And he called in a loud voice, cut down the tree and trim off its branches, strip off its leaves, scatter its fruit. Let the animals flee from under it and the birds from its branches. But let the stump and its roots, bound with iron and bronze, remain in the ground, in the grass of the field. And that's what happened to him. God has that power not only over the greatest ruler that ever lived, Nebuchadnezzar, who was ruler of the greatest kingdom this earth has ever seen. Right? We had a prophecy with all the kingdoms that would come, and guess what? Everyone was less in stature. Less in greatness, less in power. So in verse 17, we get this message. It says, the decision is announced by messengers. The holy ones declare the verdict so that the living may know that the Most High is sovereign over all the kingdoms of the earth, and he gives them to anyone he wishes and sets over them the lowliest of people. Guess what that's called? That's called God being God. That's what a God does, whatever he wants to, because he has an eternal vision. Salvation. Let's talk about salvation. Salvation is his number one priority. So we see that when the people of God try to actually do something about it, okay, you're not helping God. He doesn't need your help with political unrest. He doesn't need your help with international conflict. You don't need to pray that Vladimir Putin drops dead from a heart attack because he's so evil. God got it covered. I didn't read Acts, but in Acts, there's this story where Herod is speaking and everyone says, oh, wow, he sounds like a god. Is this the voice of God? You know what? Y'all don't believe me. Let's go there. Okay, we're going to go to Acts. Just trying to shorten my message, but I've seen too many questions like this. This isn't in the Bible. Acts 12, verse 19. And we're talking about Herod. He's going to resolve a dispute. I'm going to break it into the middle of 19, and it says, then Herod went from Judea to Caesarea, and he stayed there. He had been quarreling with the people of Tyre and Sidon. Now they joined together, and they sought an audience with him. I'm in verse 20. After securing the support of Bilatus, a trusted friend of the king, they asked for peace because they depended on the king's country for their food supply. Now in verse 21, it says, on the appointed day, Herod, wearing his royal robes, sat on his throne, and he delivered a public address to the people. So he's feeling good. He's sitting on his throne, royal robe, booming voice. And they shouted in verse 22, "This is the voice of a God, not of a man." The people said that. Herod didn't say that. But guess what? Immediately, because Herod did not give praise to God, an angel of the Lord struck him down. So God, does he have power over rulers? Can he remove someone when they do something he really don't want them to do? That's in your Bible. That's in the New Testament. That's after the death, burial, and resurrection of our Savior. That's New Testament. Okay. So I just go through the Bible and say God can remove a leader. This is what, the third one I showed you he removed? This is what I want Christians to see. So I showed you about political unrest. We talked about wars. That's what we were talking about. And conflict. This is where I feel the church is. And this is actually sobering. So we're going to read about Josiah. I'll tell you about Josiah. Josiah is probably the most righteous king that the kingdoms of Israel and Judah had. How righteous was he? Well, let's look at what Josiah did. In verse 2 Chronicles 35, I'm going to start in verse 1. 2 Chronicles 35. Okay, in 2 Chronicles 35, verse 1, it says, "Moreover, Josiah kept a Passover unto the Lord in Jerusalem, and they killed the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. And he set the priests in their charges and encouraged them to the service of the Lord. And he said unto the Levites that taught all Israel, which were holy unto the Lord, and they put the holy ark in the house which Solomon the son of David, king of Israel, did build, and it shall not be burdened on your shoulders. Serve now the Lord your God and the people of Israel. And prepare yourselves by the houses of your fathers, after the courses, according to the writing of King David." In verse 7, it says, "Josiah gave the people of the flock lambs and kids for all the Passover offerings. For all that were present, the number was 30,000 and 3,000 bullocks. Those were taken from the king's substance." So he is making sure that everyone eats in this Passover. In verse 17, it lets you know how big of a deal that was. It says, "And the children of Israel that were present kept the Passover at that time and the Feast of Unleavened Bread for 7 days." In verse 18, it says, "There was no Passover like that kept in Israel from the days of Samuel the prophet, neither did all the kings of Israel keep such a Passover as Josiah kept. The priests and the inhabitants of Israel and Judah were present in the 18th year of the reign of King Josiah, this Passover was kept." It's important because it's giving us the background of how fervent his love for God was. And I liken this a lot to what I feel a lot of church people make a mistake in doing. Because we have this passion for God, we have this zeal, and we try our best to serve him, it's easy for us to think we know what God wants and make assumptions. This is where the trouble starts for Josiah. I want you to think about that. He had just done something really great. He restored the priests to their courses. From his own wealth, He made sure everyone was fed, and they celebrated a Passover that no one has done before. It says in verse 20, after all this, when Josiah had prepared the temple, Necho, king of Egypt, came up to fight against Carchemish by the Euphrates, and Josiah went out against him. But he sent ambassadors to him, Necho did, saying, what have I to do with you, king of Judah? I come not against you this day, but against those wherein I have war. And this is important. He says, for God commanded me to make haste. Don't mess with me. God is with me. He will destroy you. Josiah was behaving the way Christians behave when we don't, because we don't have an eternal vision. See, God has an eternal vision. What does this have to do with the geopolitics of our day? Well, King Josiah was in the middle of three superpowers that were fighting. You had the Babylonians, who were the ascendant power. I don't know, let's call them China. Battling against fading powers, let's call them, I don't know, the EU and the US. And let's call Josiah, I don't know, the church. Just an analogy. You could switch the names around, doesn't matter. The point here is God's eternal vision is for the salvation of his people. He wants to protect Josiah. Everything else, he's moving chess pieces around. See, Assyria was losing its grip on power. You know how they were big and bad? They came and they took off the northern kingdom. Well, Josiah, because he was faithful to God, he got some of that land back in Israel. Remember when we read about him in the Passover? It said that all of Israel and Judah came? Because he got rid of all that idolatry. So God was blessing him. But he didn't want anyone walking through his territory. And he was happy that the Assyrians were getting it handed to them by the Babylonians. The Egyptians were on their way to help Assyria. But Necho, he's an Egyptian. God hates Egypt, right? In fact, Egypt is a synonym for sin in the Bible. We know what God has done to the pharaohs in the past. God can't possibly be using the Egyptians, can he? I don't know. Let's read and see what it says. So Necho is telling Josiah, God, I have to do this for God. I have to do this quickly for God. Nevertheless, Josiah would not turn his face from him, but disguised himself that he might fight with him. And he hearkened not unto the words from Necho from the mouth of God. What? Wait. It can't be. Necho wasn't saying what God said. He can't. He's an Egyptian. He's a pharaoh. They worship idols. Well, let's read on. Maybe it'll explain the mistakes. And they came out to fight in the Valley of Megiddo. You know where the Valley of Megiddo is, right? That's where Armageddon is supposed to happen. So I want you to think about that when we talk about battles between superpowers. It's happened there before. Verse 23. And the archers shot at King Josiah. And the king said to his servants, take me away, for I have been wounded. What? No! We just saw that Josiah was, he was the man. He did the Passover. He gave 33,000 of his livestock away to the people. And now Josiah's about to die. Shot by an arrow. In verse 24, his servants took him out of that chariot and put him in a second chariot that he had, and they brought him to Jerusalem, where he died. And he was buried with his fathers, and all of Judah and Jerusalem mourned for Josiah.
Wow.
I just read about a bad king that repented. Ahab, the worst king ever, and God took pity on him. And now we have a good king, one of the best, that disobeyed God and died. Eternal vision. We don't have time, but I want you to read verse 36, because this is what happened, because he didn't listen. He was the last true good king of Judah. He was 39 when he died. I want you to think about it. Evil Manasseh reigned 55 years. And Josiah, man of God, died at 39. After that, he had four kids, four sons. The one who replaced him on the throne was immediately removed by Necho. After the battle in Carchemish, he came right back and he said, nope, I'm taking you to Egypt with me. I think the other one died in battle. And Judah never had a good king after that. So what are we going to do about it, church? How are we going to help God with political unrest, international conflict? How are we going to help God with these promises that he made to us? I have a couple suggestions. We obey him. We love our neighbor as ourself. We love our God above all. And we stay out the way.